This is Dialogue. Dialogue, a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.
This is Dialogue Assassination with Research Specialist Mae Bressel for KLRB. I'm Gloria Barron. And today also we have a guest with Mae. This is Preston Guillory. He's a former member of the L.A. Sheriff's Department, and he just came back from testifying at the penalty phase of the Manson trial. So I think maybe we could start out with that, Mae. That's sort of a blockbuster right there.
Start with the Manson trial. Okay, before we get on to the Manson trial, you know, we did one full hour of the broadcast, and we've done comments since on the books that are coming out. I think we should make one comment about the drug scene that caused so much controversy here in Monterey last week. I was at the college, and I spoke to the students. And I spoke on the air about the effect of drugs controlling the minds of the students to reduce their interest in political activity or organization. And a lot of students took issue to my hitting upon drugs that they have been using, and they objected to my inferring that they were available, and they objected to all the suggestions that I made about the drugs. The reason I brought up the subject of drugs was because of two articles in the news the week before. One from the New York Times called Youth's Great Ego Trip is Fading Out. And the nature of the article, a long article, was giving the history of the youth of the 1960s into the 70s, and how they used to be vociferous. They objected to the war. They objected to the shooting at Kent State and Cambodia and Jackson State. But they are accepting now the fact of the assassinations and the riots and the killings. And the New York Times said, in quote, "They have survived years of crisis, conflict and turmoil, of war, assassinations, riots, and demonstrations. And now is the time for settling down and pursuing their individual interests and even their pleasures. And they have the use of marijuana that has spread through most segments of the population. It doesn't divide the hip from the straight anymore. And they are quieting down," end quotes. I feel that the problems are greater now than they were at the time of Cambodia and Kent State, and that my opinion is, based upon a lot of research and articles that I have saved, that there is a concerted effort to see that youth students do quiet down, and the radical movement either stays politically radical and then gets busted, so it becomes ineffectual and the radicals get locked up in jail through the use of grass, or the effect is to give you a false sense of being secure that doesn't really exist. Now, a lot of you can argue that having grass does not affect your capacity to respond in a certain situation. And if that's true, then why take it at all if it's illegal? If it doesn't have some effect upon you, none at all, why take a chance of being arrested? And if it does have an effect upon you, ask yourself exactly what it is. There's an article in Playboy this month by Mr. Polanski, Sharon Tate's husband, and he felt very badly that he was not with her at the time that these murders occurred. He thinks that he could have responded in a way that was more appropriate to the situation, that all of those people at the time that their house was broken into and they were massacred were on some form of drug, marijuana or other drug, and they were very passive. And when the girls broke into the house, Sue Atkins and the other girls and Tex Watson, the Folger girl looked up and said, "Well, come right in." And she was very hospitable, and she was zonked out. And Polanski had been a victim of Nazi persecution. His parents were killed in concentration camps. He had run for his life, been shot, had lived in the street of the jungle and the battle and the revolution and the war. And he would have recognized those faces as not being fellow hippies or love people at all. And he felt that his response, based upon his past experience, would have been more appropriate to what was really happening. At least there would have been a struggle of some kind. He wouldn't have given up. Now, the young people may object to that opinion of what is happening to them. And to quote another article we had last week of Lewis Tackwood, a former in the L.A. Police Department for 10 years, was involved in undercover work as an agent provocateur. And this also was in the New York Times, and he said this. This is one of his many charges. He was charged, quote, that the police allowed narcotics to be sold in Black and Chicano communities to create a dependency on the drug and to undercut political movement, end quote. Well, he limited his own experience to memos and work in the Los Angeles Police Department with Blacks and Chicanos. But my research is extensive, and I feel that it goes into the upper-class white radical community, too. And if you don't feel that you are a victim of this kind of a conspiracy to keep you at a very happy level, then you're not really aware what's going on in America. You can defend your position and say you have your full senses and that your choice of marijuana is optional and it doesn't affect your studying or where you're going. And I beg to differ with you on many, many counts. And we won't go into the drug thing now today because we have a guest. But I feel that if there's no difference between taking a drug or not taking a drug, why bother? And if there is a difference, really analyze what is happening to you. Look at yourselves and your generation and see how quiet you are now when last year you cared a lot and then next year you'll care less. The name of the game right now is mind control, and then we'll go into the Manson thing. In 1968, the slogan for elections was law and order. In 1970, they were coming down on anarchy and chaos. The 1972s are going to be mind control. And in 1963, when I began my research into who is Lee Harvey Oswald, and did 6 years of research on who he saw, who he met, where he traveled, who he was with, and who he associated with, the image of Lee Harvey Oswald was totally different than the one you were told. He was not without jobs. They told you he had no friends, no meaningful relationships, and a long list of adjectives described Lee Harvey Oswald. And I went into the origin of who was saying these things because he was a very brilliant agent who was adept at Russian language and at microdotting and photographic techniques, electronic work, radio work, and radar work in the service for several years with top security clearances. And this is a mind control to make you believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was the person, the lone person, involved in the killing of John Kennedy. Now, we did a show, an entire show, on Charles Manson, because many people don't realize that Charles Manson is in the same category as Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, and James Ray. That Charles Manson did not kill any one of the persons, seven people that he's accused of murdering or in starting the brain control of the people who did the murder. And in that new book that just came out on Manson, Ed Sanders' book called The Family, this is a quotation. If the story were known about the Tate Bianca murders, there would be a big stink of a scandal. I am silent because of the age-old code of criminal behavior that makes telling the names of those involved a crime equal to the crime itself, end quotes. Charlie Manson said it. Now, Oswald, the 2 days that he was alive after his arrest, said, I did not kill anybody. I am a patsy. Sirhan said, if the truth were out, if the world find out, they'd be very surprised by the truth. James Ray told Bradford Huey through letters, I'm a patsy. I was given money and told to be at a certain place in the South when the bullets were fired. Nobody can see him. He said he was a decoy. The biggest patsy of our state, of our times, and historically will go down as the largest patsy of this generation, perhaps bigger than Oswald Sirhanaway, is the image of Charlie Manson that was to come down on a whole class of society, namely the youth and the hippies. Now, our guest, Preston, we ought to get into the discussion of Manson. I met you about 3 weeks after I had done an hour show here on the Charles Manson story. And do you want to go into the circumstances, how your experiences in Los Angeles? Because Preston's here, and he was in on the arrest of Charles Manson, and maybe by rehashing some of his experiences and my going to my research, you can pick up some of what our Manson show is about. Do you want to tell about some of your experiences with arresting Charles Manson the first time?
Okay, I'd like to make a point right here that you were discussing what I think was the fabrication of political scapegoats in the United States. Manson, James Earl Ray, and Sirhan Sirhan. All these people were simply fabricated almost out of thin air because their backgrounds did not correlate with their situation and their attitude at the time that they were supposed killers. Manson's background, and I can point out as we go into this, in no way indicated that he had the potential for what he's supposed to have done in the manner in which it was supposed to have been accomplished. Manson is said to have been, used other people as tools to accomplish his bidding. And people that are familiar with Manson and his acts at the Spahn Ranch will tell you that Manson was the type of person who always did things which had to be done himself. He didn't believe in delegating authority. He was a person who went forward and accomplished a specific task himself without depending on other people. This I found out and developed in conversations with his attorney, Irving Kinnerig. I went down to Los Angeles the 4th of this month, which was Thursday a week ago, to testify at the penalty phase of Manson's trial for the defense. Mr. Kinnerig is attempting this time to get the sentence of life imprisonment rather than death, so he won't have two death penalties to overturn in the courts. Evel Younger, former district attorney of Los Angeles County, now our attorney general, made it in the office on the Charles Manson conviction, plain and simple. He used Manson, and he used him very completely and consumed him as a person for his own political gain, for his own ego trip, to get into the state house. And he's not finished with Manson. He's not finished using the California penal system. He's not finished using a lot of systems within the state of California for his own political gain. He's only started.
I think they've only started coming down on the youth, too. The mistrust, the idea of witchcraft, and that our good American children's minds are being controlled. This is the thing that they're going to pull out of the bag as time goes on.
Right. They try to point out that the dependency on drugs leads to desire to get into the occult and mysticism and other fringe areas. Well, fuzzy thinking, as we call it. And there's a direct correlation now between the attitude formerly held by the left on Middle America, sitting around watching a football game with a can of beer, and now you have the situation where the left is sitting around listening to a popular rock group with earphones on or just completely blasting out their eardrums while they're smoking grass or dropping acid. And there's the same situation going on there. And they don't seem to realize, unfortunately, that this is the way Middle America has been controlled for years, by satiating their desires and their aggressiveness and controlling their activity to a point, whereas they're given something they like, okay, booze or entertainment or hot, heavy rock and grass to smoke.
Yeah, and that'll keep them happy.
It's
hard to get them to get interested into just sitting down and taking a book and cross-filing it or reading it and saying, look, here is this evidence, what are you going to do with it? It's so much easier to light a joint.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a really good way out.
Well, I've long felt that the greatest handicap the American public has is their inability to correlate information. There's so much information available daily from the newspapers, underground press, radio, and TV. And if you listen and read all of these sources, you can assimilate this if you know what to read and what you're looking for. But they can't correlate it.
The problem is that once you correlate, like I work on it and I correlate it and I put it into about 1,800 subject categories. So if you talk about any one particular thing, I can pull out this file, like I showed you the one last night about Howard Hughes. The thing was in the paper yesterday about does he even exist? Tremendous power of the man and the wealth and the mystery of this person affecting social and political changes, warfare, state, and we don't even know if there is such a person. And so when I start on you, all I have to do is go to my filing cabinet and pull out a file on Howard Hughes. But if you say that to other people, they say, well, if all you say is true, I'm going to light a joint because it's too heavy for me to handle.
Yeah, well, they take the attitude, well, it's gone too far. What can I do? I'm just going to try and make my last years on Earth happy and contented. The thing is this, you have an adequate amount of time, or apparently have had an adequate amount of time to correlate and to document what you've been saying and discussing. Most people don't have this much time, but if people can get together in small groups, 5-10 people, and each of them be assigned a specific topic or area to gather information on and then pool their knowledge, set up a filing system, cross-index, this can be done. Because we're being lied to on a day-to-day basis in the press, When I was a member of the Sheriff's Department, we used to get a big kick out of reading crime accounts in the newspapers and reading the same account in the arrest report and then reading... I used to read the underground papers, and a lot of the policemen I knew did. And usually we found that the underground press was more factual in reporting crime incidents than the media was. I'm saying the Los Angeles Times and the Herald Examiner would put out false reports of a police incident, and the real facts could be found out by reading the underground press.
But even in the major newspapers, if you can't get the underground press, right after the murder of Sharon Tate and Manson was arrested, Sue Atkins said, there were two men that went in the house, and I mentioned this on another program. Well, they ran a whole trial and only said that Tex Watson was the only man, and the news media, nobody has correlated the news media's account that there were two men. They don't deny it, and they don't investigate it, and that was dropped completely, that another murder would be out at large, or like in the Frazier trial up here in Santa Cruz, or with Ray or Sirhan, the second man or more always gets away. With Oswald, the second Oswald, there's always second or third or fourth. And the major newspapers carry the story of these doubles. That's what blows my mind. It's in the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times. And still the people can't correlate this information. They will still accept the fact that Manson did it. But before I met you, and I had been doing a couple of years research on the Manson family and said this was a political murder and Manson was a patsy, I tried to show the listeners the chronology of this particular case. And then after I met you, you told me how you worked in the Sheriff's Department, and they arrested Manson and let him go and even had foreknowledge of him before the Sharon Tate massacre, that he could have been confined in jail and those murders wouldn't occur. Isn't that what you told me?
Exactly. Manson was on federal parole. There's no reason why he should have been on the street at the time the Tate killings went down. Very simply stated, Manson was on parole from 1967 forward. During that period, I know of no job that he held which would have constituted a job as the parole board looks upon a job. He was living at the Spahn Ranch, not a place where a parolee normally is expected to live. He had access to alcohol, narcotics, and illicit sex. When I say illicit sex, I'm talking about minor girls. And all this was going down in full with full knowledge of his parole officer, as well as the officers at Malibu Patrol Station.
And machine guns.
Right.
The parolee with the weapons.
When I was at Malibu, we knew that there were machine guns being fired on the Spahn Ranch. We had citizen complaints about this. We had firemen who were on the fire trails and were stopped by members of Manson's band who were armed with machine guns and told they couldn't go there because, you know, they were using this road or something. And while this was going on, we were forbidden to make arrests. The station had a policy prior to the Spahn Ranch raid, which was for Grand Theft Auto. Our policy was make no arrests, take no police action towards Manson or his followers. And needlessly, any thinking officer would have said, this is fuzzy thinking. Why is he being left on the streets? Because there were numerous crimes being committed by Manson and his group. And case in point, Manson was arrested once prior, to my knowledge, once prior to the Spahn Ranch raid, he was arrested for a statutory rape. And there were just so many things going down which were criminal in nature, but no action was taken. All this information we were directed to put on a memo with a cover sheet so it couldn't be read by people who didn't have business reading it and was going directly to intelligence via the station captain. And we don't know what intelligence was doing with all this information, but we do know that the officers in uniform were being used to a certain extent to keep Manson under surveillance. I don't know if Manson was under surveillance by intelligence or not. I can only speculate. My best guess is, you're damn right he was under surveillance. Yeah. If not by our intelligence, by some intelligence. I want to digress for a moment, get into the area of what constitutes most major police departments.
Yeah, go ahead.
I feel that within most metropolitan areas, people are policed by three different police departments, all within one police department. Now, let's break that down. The first unit is the unit the public has contact with, the fellas in the black and white cars. They do a fantastic job in most cases. They find lost children, they get dogs out of trees, or cats, whatever's fair. They issue citations, they investigate traffic accidents, they do a pretty good job. Now, we have the second group. This is the tactical unit. They call themselves the TAC Squad, or the Crime Prevention Unit, or the Special Enforcement Bureau. Depends on what part of the state you're living in, what they call them. They all do basically the same thing. They're a unit, usually 50 to 100 men, hand-picked, and usually for their size, their aggressiveness, and their controllability. and their lack of sensitivity, lack of empathy. These men are used as an enforcement arm of the third agency within that police department I'm going to talk about. The third agency is the one that we want to get to. That is the intelligence unit. The intelligence unit, working closely with the department head, be the sheriff or the chief of police, formulate departmental policy. They're like the CIA. They formulate policy and develop political attitudes and postures towards their dealing with militant groups. They're on the right, on the left. Of course, they don't care about the right. They don't care what the right does. Their only concern is what the left is doing. And they use the tactical unit as their enforcement arm, the way we would use the army.
Yeah.
And if we ever see in this country, as Louis Tackwood has alleged about the bomb, which will be detonated at the
72 convention
in San Diego, and then the ensuing riot, which will be instigated by provocateurs in the crowd, if this goes down, you mark my words, the people who will be going out and doing the majority of the arrests on the national emergency, which is going to be declared after this, if this goes down, will be these various tac squads and tactical units. They'll be supported by the rank-and-file policemen. But as such, these elite little units will be responsible for kicking doors in and taking people out in the middle of the night, circa 1944, Nazi Germany. This is where we're coming to. I've worked with people who went onto these tactical units in L.A. County. I know what they're like. I know what their political philosophy is. I know what their mentality is. And intellectually, they frighten me. They really do.
You see, Greece was overthrown in 1967 by a group of underlings. It wasn't the colonel, not the generals of the elite guard or the aristocracy. It was the underlings that came in and worked their way up positions behind positions, who controlled the tanks and the radios. Those were the two big things that they could cut off the roads and the communication. And all the telephone lines and everything were cut, but they could control... They kept the communication open between themselves, and everyone else was cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tanks march off the streets. The actual strategy of studying Greece is very interesting. I wish more people would do that instead of worrying about Gettysburg and the Civil War battles or play chess in the evening. If you just study the tactics of how you can close off Greece, and then you go into the financing of Greece, and you see the people that are in power, then you realize where we're at, and these behind-the-scene cops are of one ilk politically. You know, apropos of that, I brought in an article that was in the news this week. It was in the Jack Anderson column about the man who has the key to the White House. And this is the quote. He is Tom Pappas, a Greek-American who runs Essos Works in Greece. Back in 68, he helped wangle the vice presidential nomination for Greek-American Spyro Agnew and raised millions for the GOP from wealthy Greeks if Richard Nixon would take Agnew as his running mate. Now, the governor of Maryland isn't just in there for a reason. But if Richard Nixon is killed, and there's a good chance he could be, or in a state of national emergency, these behind-the-scene people, like in Greece, and Mr. Pappas would know about those, this is the kind of scene, those tax squads come in and take over the whole thing. They create a riot, and they say, well, we'll investigate the riot. And they say, our intelligence tells us there's this many enemies in this place, and they take over. Tell about your arrest of Charlie Manson and how they let him go the first time, when they could have held him.
The arrest of Charles Manson at the Spahn Ranch was the biggest circus I've ever been involved in my life. We attacked the Spahn Ranch on Saturday morning at dawn, 1 week after the Tate killings. Our department supposedly had no knowledge at the time of the Tate killings and Manson's involvement in the killings. We had 102 deputies. Now, the entire strike force consisted of all of the SEB, Special Enforcement Bureau deputies from L.A. County, plus most of the men from Malibu, and two helicopters and about 35 to 40 radio cars. And I thought we were taking Iwo Jima, to be quite frank. I was waiting to put up a flag. But we got in there, and we started kicking doors down. We had a search warrant for Grand Theft Auto. And Manson was arrested and very brutally beaten by the Enforcement Bureau deputies.
Really?
Yes.
That wasn't...
He was found hidden under some steps in one of the fake storefronts
uh-huh.
at the Spahn Ranch. Yeah, this didn't go in the arrest report, of course.
They heard him.
They heard him.
Yeah.
Very definitely. They wanted to hurt him because Manson was it was a sexual thing with the deputies at Malibu.
Yeah.
Manson was a local stud, and he was he was held in contempt by the deputies because Manson had an ever-ending supply of pretty young girls at the Spahn Ranch. And a lot of the deputies were, quite frankly, on it. You know, envious. This scrawny young, ex-con scoring constantly. And they were, going home by themselves. But anyway, digressing. The thing was that Manson was not very well liked because of what he stood for. You know, he was everything that the rank and file officer was against. I mean, he didn't stand for motherhood or the sanctity of the church, and you know, Sunday football and contact sports, and you know, he wasn't a he-man.
But still, the orders, they don't arrest him. That must have killed the deputies. They couldn't arrest him. You know, they couldn't.
Not until we had this beautiful arrest warrant, the search warrant. Then we could arrest him.
Yeah,
subsequently, to the arrest, the charges were dropped 72 hours later.
Were the guys on the force mad? Were they suspicious?
They weren't suspicious. I don't think they were aware enough to be suspicious. It's just that they started thinking about this, and they said, wow, what a big farce.
I mean,
so much manpower. It was like we were doing something perhaps a week late to show that we had really been watching Manson. And now here's an interesting hypothesis I'm going to discuss. Now, if we were watching Manson prior to the Spahn Ranch raid and Manson committed these killings, we would have seen Manson. Okay. And if we weren't watching him prior to the raid, how did we justify getting the search warrant and making the raid?
And the helicopters and...
Everything seems to cancel everything else out in this discussion of what Manson was about and what our intelligence was about. I don't think Irving Kinnerick, Manson's attorney, has been able to gain access to the Intelligence Bureau's reports on Manson. And I personally feel that the surveillance of Manson was not just a local thing.
Don't you think the defense of Manson would be to demand the papers about him that they had before the murder? Or will they burn those? You know, this morning we were reading the morning paper. It showed a picture of the grand jury testimony. Did you see that at Kent State? And I cross-filed the evidence in the John Kennedy murder. Evidence destroyed, evidence altered, evidence missing. Well, now in the Kent State, there's a hearing that'll go on, and people have been indicted for inciting this riot. But the grand jury testimony was burned, and they are so open about, like now at the Germany, there's a picture on the front page of the San Jose Mercury of a wastebasket and a fire, and page by page, the grand jury report is being burned. It is an open state of fascism that people can't even believe. They're just flaunting it at you. Okay, you want this? We're burning it. Where Dr. Humes, at the time of Oswald's autopsy, and they say, well, where the original autopsies, he said it was destroyed by burning. Now they're photograph burning the evidence. And how do you handle this, Chris? What do you do with this kind of handling? If Kinnerick can't get the memos of Manson before the crime was committed, and if he's a political patsy, why can't he put the responsibility on the people who had foreknowledge of Manson? Why can't the trial be called off if they can't produce that?
Well, there's two areas we get into here, May, that Kinnerick's primary concern might be to save Manson's life, to acquit Manson. And to do this, he may have to conduct his defense in such a manner that he does not go into a conspiracy thing or an assassination trip, because this could damage the case and result in him not getting the charges reduced or dropped and later court challenges.
Yeah, but you see, when there's an intense desire by Evel Younger and Richard Nixon and John Mitchell to go in the news media and tell you Manson's guilty, they're not going to ever drop anything on Manson. Because if he was a patsy, they're certainly going to keep that death penalty going. And when you choose Rehnquist as the justice of the Supreme Court, who's the attorney for Nixon and Mitchell, and they're going to make the decision on the lives of 600 men in death row, what do you think he's going to say about Charles Manson? And James Ray and Sirhan. Well, Ray's gets 99 years in jail, but Sirhan, what's he going to say about the death penalty? Don't they want their patsies dead?
True. I'm personally waiting to see if James Earl Ray, Sirhan, and Manson develop cancer in jail as Jack Ruby did. Apparently, there's something in the jail atmosphere that's conducive to people developing fatal diseases.
Well, let me read you. You know, if you wanted to get to these...
Lead poisoning, perhaps.
You know, there...
a bullet.
There was a book that came out. It's called Search for Justice, that we've talked about, the program, by John Siegenthaler. And I made some notes on that book before we came in today on how James Ray is guarded. Now, James Ray had said to Bradford Huey and to Mr. Haynes that there was a conspiracy and that he was a patsy. And the book goes into the fact that he left the Missouri State Prison and nobody bothered to look for him. There was no call set out for him. And Judge Battle has kept tight control. He's passed away now. The other judge has kept tight control on the unanswered questions. But this is the way you get to James Ray, in case you want to know what you do with these people. If they don't have cancer, this is the way you get to him. And I'm reading the book now, page 166. There are steel plates that cover the cell windows before he was brought there from England. Closed-circuit television cameras are installed in the cell, so every movement is monitored. Brilliant fluorescent lights around the cell that are never turned off night or day.